Well, good evening, and I'm delighted to see so many of you here for tonight's lecture. I'd also like to welcome those who are watching in an overspill room. And given the amount of interest, we're hoping to have tonight's lecture available as a podcast, technical facilities permitting. Hopefully that would be available in the next few days. Tonight's lecture is part of a new series of public lectures here at the school on the theme of Brexit and the implications of Brexit, what might happen and with what effect. So there will be a series of lectures, and I simply invite you to keep in touch with the LSE website for the LSE events page to see notices of upcoming events. Let me also say, though, that we already know some of the upcoming events. This Friday lunchtime, in this same lecture theatre, at 1:30, no tickets is required, although given the number of people here tonight, that might be a dangerous proposition. But on Friday at 1:30 here in this lecture theatre, we will have a public lecture with the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz. Also, let me signal that we will have Craig Oliver, formerly Director of Policy and Communications for David Cameron while as Prime Minister, speaking here on the 14th of November, and the details will be announced on the LSE events website in the next few days. I'm not suggesting that after this week you pause and wait until the 14th of November, because there will be a number of other public lectures like this between now and then. So please look out for the events. But the programme of the LSE, which is focusing on Brexit, is one which is shared across different departments here at the school, so we'll be able to take account of different disciplinary perspectives, and there will be different topics and different speakers coming to address the theme. Now, of course, tonight we're focusing on the economics of Brexit and the implications. Already, of course, there's been much debate as to whether the warnings of the economic impact of Brexit have been realised, whether they may still be realised, whether there were exaggerations during the campaign, whether people were misled. Well, in this first lecture, we can address some of these issues, and I'm delighted that we have our speaker here this evening to guide us through the debate and to give us his accounts and arguments. David Smith has been the economics editor of the Sunday Times for almost three decades, David. He became economics editor of the Sunday Times when there was still a Berlin Wall, before the euro was agreed, before the euro crisis. So he has reported, observed, and written about the economics of the European Union, the economics of the Eurozone, for a number of years. Indeed, he has been quite prolific also as an author of a number of well-known books. The Rise and Fall of Monetarism, From Boom to Bust, Will Europe Work?, The Age of Instability, Free Lunch, which seems to be particularly intriguing, and most recently, Something Will Turn Up. And that gets us to the topic of tonight's lecture and the title. David Smith has chosen the title of Britain After Brexit, Will Something Continue to Turn Up? As is usual with these lectures, we're inviting David to speak for perhaps 40, 45 minutes. We'll then have a question and answer session with the audience. There should be plenty of time for that. And as we finish tonight's lecture, we're going to ask David to remain on stage, and you'll have seen as you entered the theatre, there are copies of some of his recent books, and you could ask him to sign those books for you. So we have a nice schedule and clearly a lot of interest in tonight's lecture and being guided through this difficult agenda. So can you please join me in giving a very warm welcome to the LSE to David Smith, Economics Editor.
Thank you, and good evening, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be back at the LSE, and a great honour to be kicking off this this series on Brexit and the consequences of Brexit. And I'm sure it's going to be a fascinating programme in the coming months and years. So the question is, as has been mentioned, after the Brexit vote, what is going to happen? Will something continue to turn up? The famous phrase, of course, from Mr. Micawber in David Copperfield, the eternal optimist. Is it possible to be optimistic about Brexit? Now, of course, it's less than 3 months since the voters of the UK opted for Brexit, and these are very early days, and Kevin mentioned some of the debate about the economics and the economic warnings, and I'll come on to that in a second. Just a little bit of history and context I thought might be quite useful. And, you know, the Brexit vote in some ways was the end of a friendship which hasn't always gone that smoothly. And I think partly the history conditions European attitudes towards the UK and towards the Brexit vote. I don't think the rest of the EU was as upset by the prospect of the UK leaving as they might have been some other member countries leaving. And I think that goes back to the very early days of European cooperation, European integration. Of course, the first serious move towards European integration was the coal and steel community. At that stage, in the early 50s, coal and steel were the two biggest industries. And the coal and steel community, the Treaty of Paris, signed, of course, by the original six. And there was no serious question of Britain being part of that. Response, as set out here, was quite hostile. You know, that this was never going to get, you know, Britain at the time had a huge coal mining industry, a huge steel industry, something like 700,000 coal miners. And the mining unions were firmly against this, as were the unions in the steel industry. Herbert Morrison, you may know Peter Mandelson. Herbert Morrison was Peter Mandelson's grandfather, and just gave a fairly short and rather terse response to this, that it was never going to get past the union, so we wouldn't consider it. Similarly, with the next stage of European integration, the EEC and the Treaty of Rome, and in the run-up to the Treaty of Rome, we didn't even send government ministers to the negotiations. We sent a senior civil servant, the famous pipe-smoking Russell Bretherton. Now, there is a dispute about whether he was actually quite as rude as this. Apparently in his parting remarks at the Messina conference, he said that this project, the EEC, had no chance of working, and good luck to you, but we're having nothing to do with it. That, as I say, partly conditions attitudes to it. It's interesting that, to me, that these things can turn around quite quickly. So, within a fairly few years of that, we were suddenly quite keen to be members of this new EEC. And the pressure to be for membership was partly to do with politics, and I think at that time the United States was very keen that we were part of that, but mainly to do with economics and business. Businesses started to complain that we were being left behind in the UK by this new spirit of cooperation. The EEC was driving much faster economic growth in the rest of Europe than it was in the UK among the original six. Our first response to it was to set up an alternative body, EFTA, as some of you may remember. There were six members of the EEC, seven members of EFTA, and the joke at the time was that Europe was at sixes and sevens. But, you know, that was not seen by, particularly by business, as being an adequate substitute for the much larger EEC. Of course, we then came up against the two vetoes by General de Gaulle, the French president. And it's quite interesting to me that some of these things, you know, his comments on Britain being different, Britain being hostile towards Europe, had quite a lot of echoes during the referendum campaign. You know, we're a different sort of country, insular and maritime, was de Gaulle's first response, and the second one, it was deep hostility. And on both occasions, we were membership was vetoed. Once de Gaulle was out of the way in 1969, it opened up towards membership, and of course we joined at the beginning of 1973. And then shortly afterwards, as you will know, we had a referendum on continued membership of the EEC in 1975. Now, some of us thought that you know, the lessons of the 75 referendum might mean something for the 2016 referendum. And unfortunately, and the lessons of the 75 referendum was that when the campaign started, apparently there was quite a lot of hostility to continued EEC membership. It was 60-40 in the polls at the start of 1975 for leaving the EEC that we just joined. But by the time of the vote, there was a big shift back towards what was then the status quo, remaining in the EEC, and it was a 2-1 vote in favour. So, you know, public opinion shifted quite markedly in a relatively short period of time, just in a few months. And I think those of us who are looking for, you know, maybe the what you know what the pollsters call status quo bias to come through in this referendum, and that in the end people would vote for what they knew rather than what and in 1975 they barely knew it, but they voted for what the government told them was best, and you know the. Parties were then as now split, but in fact the 75 referendum does not appear to have carried any lessons at all for 2016. Our period within the EEC/EU has often been fraught, and one of those periods when it was fraught was in 1992, humiliating episode for the UK, we'd relatively recently and quite late on, and it's a feature of, or had been a feature of the UK and the EU, that we tend to join things quite late. So we joined the EEC quite late, we joined the ERM, the exchange rate mechanism, quite late. Exchange rate mechanism came into being in 79, we didn't join until 1990, and our humiliating exit from it, despite all the efforts of the authorities, raising interest rates to ridiculous levels, using all the country's foreign exchange reserves to try and preserve sterling within the system, it didn't work, and we dropped out. I mean, the effects of dropping out appear to have been beneficial for the UK economy. It marked the start of a long period of economic recovery, but it was a humiliating episode. But even that did not appear to provoke an enormous amount of Euroscepticism in the UK. And if you look at this, the attitude, UK attitudes to EU membership, this is from British Social Attitudes. So it's a properly conducted academic study, which is done annually. And based on face-to-face interviews, so, of course, when it started, there was no such thing as the internet, so you didn't have online polling, you know, properly conducted interviews. And as you can see, almost all the way through, there's a brief wobble around about 1984, and that's the time when Margaret Thatcher is negotiating the rebate from the EU budget. But throughout all this period, the settled position of the British people seems to be that we're in the EU and we're going to stay in the EU. There's no serious question of us leaving. And in fact, people, until relatively recently, people who posed the question, you know, we should get out now, you know, get Britain out and all that thing, were regarded very much on the extremes of politics. You know, they were not anywhere near the political mainstream. So, as I say, the settled position of the British people seemed to be that, EU membership is, if not permanent, it is where we are, and there's no real question of us withdrawing, which makes the decision to hold a referendum quite an interesting one. It is almost as though it provoked feelings and attitudes that people didn't know they had, you know. So, and provoked a Euroscepticism, which was perhaps there on an underlying basis, but which came to the surface in the referendum campaign. So, why did we vote to leave? Why did 17.4 million people vote to leave, as against 16.1 million people voting to stay? I think the technicalities of this were, and the reason why, you know, certainly many pollsters got it wrong, certainly the bookmakers got it very badly wrong, and many people who, including myself, who thought there would be, you know, the economic arguments would be very strong and it would move back towards the status quo and people would decide on the least risky option, which was continued membership. The one thing I don't think anybody allowed for was that we saw at least in one important respect, a different kind of electorate or a different portion of the electorate than we normally have. So, you know, there were a considerable number, and estimates vary, but it could be as high as 3 million normal non-voters who voted in the referendum, who aren't touched at all by the pollsters. You know, the first thing pollsters want to know is, how did you vote last time? If people didn't vote last time, it's very difficult to get to them. And, you know, these are not people who would take part in online surveys. They're people who would put the phone down if a pollster rings and says, we want to get your attitudes towards EU membership. And in many cases, and I had some personal experience of this, that people who voted, and there was a view in the before the referendum, when the period of voter registration was extended, and the assumption was that extending voter registration, getting more young people into the electorate, into the relevant electorate, would actually help the Remain side, because young people were more likely to vote to remain in the EU. Some of them had not registered, so there was a campaign to get them to register, and that was quite successful. But I think people didn't allow, you know, and so the higher the turnout, you know, the more likely a Remain vote. But, you know, the people who, in Nigel Farage's words, you know, were prepared to crawl over broken glass to vote in the referendum, the normal non-voters. And the people I encountered, in some cases were in middle age or late middle age, had often not voted before, you know. In one case, somebody had last voted in 1983, you know, which is quite a long time. I witnessed the polling officer at one polling station saying, "Well, we'll see you next time. You know, we'll see you for the next set of local elections or the next general election." And to which the response was, "No, you know, you'll never see us again. That was our one vote." And so, you know, so people, you know, there was a, you know, a kind of almost a separate type of electorate. Now, that wasn't, of course, the whole story. I mean, you know, many people voted to leave, having, you know, being regular voters and deciding that was the best thing to do. So why did they do that? I mean, one of the things I think, you know, I think everybody would agree, whatever you think of the EU, it hasn't been a good few years for the EU. So the Eurozone crisis has, I mean, even people who were very strongly in favour of European integration and everything it stood for, you know, particularly the way the Eurozone crisis was handled, the treatment of some countries, you know, maybe some of those countries are irresponsible beforehand, but were treated quite brutally during the Eurozone crisis. And more particularly, the migrant crisis and the Germany's open door policy exposed divisions, particularly divisions between the older members of the EU and the newer members in Eastern Europe, which I don't think we'd really seen before, apart from, you know, the images of migrants, you know, struggling to get over barbed wire fences, you know, struggling to get across into Europe at any cost and so on. All that was, the most terrible PR for the EU. So that affected attitudes, even for people who would normally, I think, have been pro-EU. I think another thing, and I would confess to getting this entirely wrong, I had thought that this consumer confidence, you know, it's maybe a bit of a will-o'-the-wisp concept, but consumer confidence has been measured, and this particular survey I always focus on, the GFK survey, is actually funded by the European Commission. So it may be in its last few years. But this measure of consumer confidence goes back to 1973 when we joined the EEC. And interestingly enough, recent levels of consumer confidence, pre-referendum, but throughout 2015, the early part of 2016, were the highest they've ever been. So people were upbeat because employment growth was strong, inflation was very low, so real incomes were rising, and consumers were confident. And I always thought that would be a good reason why, the majority of people would say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why would we risk changing that? And if people are warning about those risks, now maybe, and I'm not saying that, I would not dismiss, that component of the electorate who weren't feeling that confident, who were feeling left behind, insecure, and so on. But many, many people were quite comfortably off. Global financial crisis a few years ago, they could take a risk with Brexit. They didn't feel it could harm them. They were confident enough to risk it. Whereas I had thought they would be, because they were confident, because they were doing well, they wouldn't want to risk it. So I think that was quite important. But even more important, of course, was migration. And the interesting thing about net migration, I think the turning point of the campaign was the release by the ONS of figures showing that net migration in 2015 was 330,000, a long way from the tens of thousands promised by David Cameron. And it was quite interesting that whatever arguments you used about migration, the fact that there is and always has been for the entire period we've been in the EEC stroke EU, more immigration into the UK from outside the EU than from inside the EU. So non-EU net migration is higher than EU net migration. The fact that, the argument about, migrants taking jobs does not work. If you looked at the numbers, the proportion of UK-born people in employment at the moment is at a record level, as is overall employment. So, migrants, economic migrants have contributed to the labour market, they've contributed to labour market flexibility, they contribute to the public finances, but none of that mattered. I mean, people who thought there was too much immigration were going to vote to leave, come what may. I mean, and arguments didn't really work in that. And that was the most powerful factor. So where do we go from here? Where do we? This was the moment captured by the Times cartoonist Peter Brooks when Boris came out for Brexit. After famously writing two articles, one for Remain and one for Leave, and then deciding on the Leave vote, and without any expectation that his side, the side he chose, the Leave side, would win. I mean, his assurance to David Cameron, you'll hear more about this from Craig Oliver when he comes here, was that there isn't much chance of us winning this, but I've got to do it. So where do we go from here? I think that it's useful to think of three stages of Brexit. So the first stage is the one we're in. Most people did not expect a Brexit vote. So the initial shock and how that panned out, so political, financial and economic. Second stage is when Article 50 is invoked. Now, Article 50, I think, was put into the treaties without any expectation that it would ever be used. So I think the Article 50 process is intended to be a two-year exit process. Now, as I'll come to explain, it's very optimistic to think that you could exit the EU in all respects within 2 years. And then the third stage, and perhaps the most important, is the post-Brexit settlement. What kind of relationships do we have with both with the EU and elsewhere? So those are the three stages. And in terms of the first, I mean, Kevin mentioned this. Was there a shock or wasn't there? Well, certainly as far as sterling was concerned, there was a shock. And the reason sterling fell was because of the expectation in the markets that UK growth prospects would be less good outside the EU than they were inside. So it was a re-evaluation combined with a devaluation of sterling, and sterling remains low. I mean, it's around about 130 at the moment. There's been a little bit of recovery, but it's down again in the last few days. So that is that is the financial shock, and that did occur. If we look at what happened initially on most of the economic indicators and most of the survey data, there was a very sharp fall in confidence and in some measures of economic activity. So, for a brief time, it did seem as though we were heading for something quite nasty. So, the people who say that, it was nothing, it was, we took it in our stride, that was not the case. This is the purchasing managers' surveys, but other surveys showed a sharp fall in business confidence. That consumer confidence measure I mentioned earlier also fell very sharply. It remained at historically high levels, but it did fall quite sharply. So there was an effect there. But things did bounce back, and things did recover, and recovered reasonably quickly. So July was pretty bad on all these surveys. August was a lot better. Now, why was that? I think several reasons. One is that the fear that this would be some sort of global financial shock was not justified. And that was the kind of warnings you did hear from organisations like the IMF. The financial markets globally saw this as a sort of relatively small local event, took it in their stride, and moved on to the things that they obsess about, which is, what's going to be the next move in interest rates by the Federal Reserve. So they didn't regard this as particularly large. And we may see a similar reaction should Donald Trump get elected in November. Maybe slightly bigger there, but it wasn't really a big global event. It doesn't seem to have provoked a renewed crisis in Europe. So one of the arguments was that Britain would be the first domino to fall, and a Brexit vote would bring forward lots of Euroscepticism elsewhere, and lots of other countries would want referendums, and the whole thing could fall apart. If anything, there's been something of a move back in some countries. I mean, there were Spanish elections quite soon after the British referendum, which seemed to signal a move back towards the mainstream. Things are a bit more complicated, as in Germany because of the migration issue. But it wasn't. It doesn't seem to provoke an immediate European crisis. But also, very important was that it didn't provoke the kind of sustained political chaos that that was feared. Now, many people voted to leave and were quite shocked when David Cameron resigned the next day. And it was quite uncertain what might have happened then. I mean, we could have had a summer of uncertainty. The Conservative leadership contest, had it taken place in the normal way, would only have been concluded a week or so ago, and that would have been a recipe for quite sustained political uncertainty. What kind of government are we going to get? Is it going to be a government that aims for a hard, early Brexit, which business would have hated? So you could, if that had happened, I think things could have been quite different. And also the Bank of England responding in quite a timely but also quite a dramatic way, I think helped to calm nerves. And it was almost the equivalent of Mario Draghi, the European Central Bank president, back in 2012, saying he'd do whatever it takes. I mean, Mark Carney almost said, we'll do whatever it takes to keep this economy going during this period of uncertainty. So I think all those things helped. It is still the case that I don't think one should get carried away by, a sudden fall in activity followed by a rise. If you look at the GDP numbers on a monthly basis, which the National Institute of Economic and Social Research does, things seem to be relatively flat. And if you look at the forecasts, forecasts are have to be taken with a pinch of salt, of course, but most of the forecasts are still for a slowdown in the economy, for the remainder of this year and into next year, for the simple reason that the expectation is that consumers will not be spending quite as freely when the fall in the pound pushes up inflation and squeezes their real incomes, but also businesses will be, you know, less willing to invest and recruit because of the uncertainty and the uncertainty that runs into the invoking of Article 50. So I think, although it's I regard it not as a great disappointment or a great failure of forecasting that things have settled down and stabilised. But I think it would be unwise for anybody to say, well, that's it. You know, that was all the Brexit effect that we've had over the last 3 months. There's plenty to go. The way we're ahead now, I think, is still very uncertain. You know, and I hope everybody can see that, because that is our Foreign Secretary, and happier times, you know. But so where are we heading, and what is our post-Brexit future going to be? Could it not happen? You know, is there a possibility that the people will change their minds, and that Article 50 is never invoked? This is the fear among some of the more ardent Brexiteers that if the government is allowed to delay even for a few months invoking Article 50, then there is a great danger of slippage. You know, something else could come up. You know, something could intervene. A big national event, or, you know, whatever it might be, a crisis of different nature, and invoking Article 50 would be delayed permanently as a result of that, and somehow we would never leave. I don't think that is going to happen. And I think the fact that we do have a Prime Minister who campaigned, albeit rather quietly, on the Remain side, means that she is almost under greater pressure to do this, and to, you know, as she keeps saying, Brexit means Brexit. And I think also, had the short-term economic and political consequences been worse than they have been, you know, had there been an immediate dive into recession, which is always unlikely, had there been a kind of, you know, a political crisis, had the government become ungovernable, then people might have changed their mind, and you might have got a response, a public response, which said we only wanted to teach you a lesson, you know, we didn't really mean it. But I don't think that is going to happen. So I think we should assume that that Brexit means Brexit. And I don't think it's sensible for politicians to say, you know, we need a second referendum. Because I think it's quite likely, if, other countries may be different, but I think if you had a second referendum, people would regard that as, in some senses, cheating. So, it could even be a bigger majority for Leave than the first one. So I don't think people should hold out too many hopes. I mean, there are possibilities, but I wouldn't put them very high. It's going to be a long process, you know. I mean, this. I think it's quite probable that that Article 50 will be, will be invoked. Will be. The process will start probably quite early in 2017. I think. I mean, the suggestion that it will be January, February has been slightly knocked down by Downing Street, but I don't think it will be long beyond that. But it is a very long process. I think that 2 years is not realistic. I mean, we will have, you know, all those things that the Brexiteers protest about, you know, the mainly single market rules that are still on the UK statute book will be there for very many years. You know, it's not, they're not going to all go in 2 years' time. There'll be a sort of piecemeal dismantling, but it will take a long time. And, you know, dealing with other countries will take many years. So the question is, how do you, given all that, and given that is the risk, how do you try and ensure that, you know, that something does turn up, and that it could, you know, it is a better Brexit than it could be? You know, what are the conditions you would want to achieve a good Brexit, a good outcome amid all this uncertainty? The first thing, and I, you know, one of the, you know, there are many horrible things about the campaign, and much dishonesty. The most dishonesty I can remember in any political campaign I've ever seen. There did not seem to be any control of outright lies, and, you know, there was no authority to say you just can't say that, you know, because it's not true. Neither the, I mean, you know, we tried in the newspapers to, you know, point out things when they were wrong, but I don't think enough pointing out of things that were wrong was done by the national broadcasters, for example. I think they tended to say, well, it's six of one, half dozen the other, you can say what you like. And that was, I think that was quite damaging. But one positive thing was that there was some discussion about, you know, the economy's underlying weaknesses, both in the sense of, you know, how inclusive economic growth has been, but also some of the things that we need to fix, and I'll come on to that. The second one is that, you know, the Article 50 process, I think in particular businesses will be looking for a pretty clear sign of where the end point is intended to be. You know, what are we aiming for? Is it achievable? And is it achievable within a reasonable time frame? And although, you know, it's strictly against the rules, and, you know, my own newspaper carried a story saying that the, you know, it's possible that that the European Commission could fine us even for talking informally to other countries. I think that process has to start informally. If you want to negotiate post-Brexit trade deals with other countries, you need to get, you know, at least some of the groundwork done now. In terms of the underlying weaknesses, one of them, which will be familiar to people here, is, of course, that productivity has been stagnant for the last few years since the global financial crisis. And, you know, to use Paul Krugman's famous quote, you know, productivity isn't everything, but in the long run, it's almost everything. If you don't have productivity growth, you don't have prosperity, you don't have competitiveness, and your public finances get to be a lot worse. And in terms of, you know, the UK's position on productivity, certainly, you know, there is considerable weakness to address. This is GDP per hour worked. As you can see, most countries have considerably higher productivity than the UK, and the gap at the moment is the biggest it's been for about 25 years. So there is an underlying problem there. And also, you know, and the new Prime Minister has talked about this, there's also a gap when it comes to, you know, differential performance within the UK, that, you know, the London productivity is very, very, and London and the South East productivity is very much higher than in the rest of the country, as is prosperity and so on. So these are things that have been there for a very long time, but do need addressing. If you want to bestride the world as a new and competitive force, you need to make yourself more competitive, more productive, and also address, you know, what is one of the fundamental weaknesses of the UK economy, which is the current account of the balance of payments, very large deficit. This is the indicator that led Mark Carney to say that post-Brexit we would be dependent upon the kindness of strangers, you know, people who will still be prepared to invest in the UK in order to offset this large current account deficit. And the interesting thing about the current account deficit is, you know, we've had a weakness in terms of our trade position for a long time, but the weakness at the moment is on the things that we were traditionally very good at, which was earning more on our investments overseas than foreigners earned in the UK, and that has not been the case for the last two or three years. So there is a vulnerability there. So all those things need to be addressed. And, you know, without being too flattering to the LSE, in terms of the short, medium and long-term things you need to do, I would recommend the report of the Growth Commission, the LSE Growth Commission, which was very thorough, went into all the areas, including skills, including the need for more infrastructure spending, of raising productivity, raising competitiveness and so on. So, you know, the government would do well to spend some time looking at that and other reports. So there is an economic problem that needs fixing. So that should be part of it. So it's not just a question of how you organise Brexit, how you organise trade deals. You need to address some of the underlying weaknesses. In terms of Article 50 and the two-year process, it can't go on too long, I think, because again, you know, the longer it goes on, the more suspicious the Brexit camp will be that it's not going to happen. So there will be pressure. You know, Theresa May is enjoying a honeymoon period at the moment, but there will be pressure to invoke it before the middle of next year. So, and it, at the moment, I think it is a pretty blank sheet of paper. You know, if you think about the campaign and those of you who observed it. You know, there wasn't a lot of policy on the Leave side. So, and the bits of policy that were there, such as, you know, the famous Australian-style points-based system, has already been dropped by, you know, as unworkable by the new Prime Minister. And so she can decide what kind of, what kind of vision of our relationship with Europe she wants. But, you know, there are still plenty of hardliners within both within the cabinet and within the Conservative Party. But the other thing I think is that how do you make things really clear so everybody in the country has a good idea about where we want to end up and the kind of things we'll be looking for without giving the game away to the people you'll be negotiating with. Now, this was what David Cameron frequently did, which was to, overpromise and underdeliver in his negotiations with Europe. She won't want to do that, but that will mean there has to be a certain amount of, there can't be that much clarity. You know, there will have to be some cloudiness. There will be times when, you know, businesses will say, well, we just don't know what you're trying to do here. You know, it seems very unclear. It seems very opaque. And that is a risk. And I think this, you know, the risk is that the Article 50 process will be, you know, a period of considerable uncertainty. And I think that is quite a dilemma for the government. What would we and what should we be aiming for? Of course, you know, there are, and these were debated, you know, before the referendum, sort of off-the-shelf deals that, Norwegian-style deal, which does involve free movement, does involve a contribution to, something like a contribution to the budget, a series of Swiss-style bilateral deals, which don't, you know, would not satisfy, I don't think, the City of London because of the financial services access. I think the assumption has been that if, you know, here in the UK, that if we wanted a Norway-style deal, and of course there are problems about free movement, then the rest of Europe would be quite happy with that. I don't think that's the case, because I think the rest of the EU is happy with a Norway-style deal for, and without insulting any Norwegians in the audience, for Norway, because it's a smaller economy, they would not be happy with a Norway-style deal for the UK. So, and I think they want to, although, you know, the talk is of a tailored deal with restricted free movement, there is the important question of whether that can be anything close to the single market. The European Economic Area membership does allow for an emergency brake on migration, but I think it doesn't allow for a permanent brake, which is what the government will be seeking. If you look at what business wants, I think this is fairly clear that, you know, we need something very similar to the single market and, you know, acknowledging that we're leaving the EU, that the post-Brexit trade deals should be negotiated as quickly as possible, and that what business doesn't want are bureaucratic, you know, points-based system. You know, so we have a points-based system for non-EU migration. Business hates that. They wouldn't want that. And, you know, of course, larger businesses can cope with quite a lot of bureaucracy. It's the smaller employers who have used, the EU labour market, the wider EU labour market, and regarded as an important source of flexibility, who would really suffer from, an over-complex system. And that is the danger, that, you know, you get, the uncertainty lasts for some time. The deal we have is greatly inferior to membership of the single market, that there's very slow progress on all the non-EU deals, and we struggle to attract inward investment. So, you know, what business wants and what business may get could be two different things. And interestingly enough, the Japanese government, as some of you may know, set out its position quite recently, and this document is publicly available on the internet. I don't know why they fully cap up Brexit, just to scare people, but To save you reading the 15 pages from the Japanese government, I can tell you in short what the Japanese government wants is that we stay in the EU. You know, and all the requirements are essentially those that can only be delivered if we continue to be EU members. But it's good to have another government, a non-EU government, setting out what is needed. And again, you know, there are risks in terms of the City of London. Now, some people say, well, you know, we'll always be the financial capital of Europe. And I think that's right. You know, we will be the biggest financial centre in Europe. But we could be the biggest financial centre in Europe if we lost 20 or 30% of current activity, and which wouldn't be good for the purposes of employment, including employment of LSE graduates, and wouldn't be good for tax receipts and all those things. And that clearly there is a risk in many respects. Quite a lot of activities could potentially be at risk from loss of participation in the single market, passporting regime, and all those things. So there are dangers there, and there's also a question of where, you know, in this fairly complex array of possibilities, you know, do we have to create an entirely new circle for the UK somewhere out on the top left-hand side, or could we slot into one of the existing ones, maybe where Iceland and Liechtenstein and Norway are, but with complications? Would we still be in the customs union? You know, some economists argue that, and some people in government argue that it's not just the single market that we should leave, but the customs union as well. So, you know, there are a range of possibilities here. This is very early stage stuff. I mean, you know, nobody in government seriously expected to be doing any of this. You know, the overwhelming assumption in Whitehall was that it would be a Remain vote. We've got no trade negotiating expertise, and we've got no exiting the EU expertise. You know, all that has to be built up from scratch, unsurprisingly. Something that would be, I suppose, you know, the closest I can think of to, not ideal, but better than most, would be that she's able to resist pressure for a very hard Brexit. A hard Brexit means that you're out of the single market, out of the customs union. You distance yourself quite seriously in economic terms from the rest of Europe. That, you know, for businesses and for the rest of us, you know, there is no big bang in terms of regulation, in terms of having to cope with a whole new set of laws and this Westminster as opposed to Brussels directives. That this thing happens very, very slowly over quite a long period. It's a very gradual process, and that seems to be the way intelligent MPs are thinking about this. That there's no way that we're going to repeal every EU law on the statute book. So, some control over immigration. So a settlement is as close as possible. It won't be as good as single market membership, but, you know, something that, you know, achieves an element of control over immigration. Of course, you know, immigration from the rest of Europe into the UK won't stop. It will continue at probably quite high levels, and the perception of control will be, I think, quite important. So that is what, And of course, at the moment, you know, everybody in the EU says that, you know, those things are impossible. You know, you have to make your choice. Do you want to be in or very close to the single market or accept free movement, or do you want to have control over immigration and then suffer the consequences of not being in the single market? So I think, and those positions will change, though, and they will change over time. It's not surprising to me that the rest of the EU does not, at the moment, want to present Britain with what looks like a remotely easy path towards a new future. Partly to not encourage any other countries to go down that path, but also because, you know, there are plenty of things that they could be getting on with, and Brexit has just delivered a huge millstone around not just the necks of everybody in the rest of Europe. And in terms of the long-term future, you know, what happens post EU? You know, what kind of future can we hope to have? And, of course, you know, an essential part of this is that we will continue to attract inward investment. Now, I was always surprised over many years that, you know, the rest of the EU didn't complain more about the fact that the UK, you know, was almost a cuckoo in the nest, you know, that we weren't in the euro, we have lower levels of regulation than most of the rest of Europe, and, you know, if you look at the OECD measures of product market regulation, labour market regulation, you know, the UK is very much at the very low end of that, and some EU members are at the high end, and that, of course, is very attractive to, you know, if you could gain access to the single market, operate in a relatively low regulation economy, you know, that was the ideal combination. And that's, you know, the inward investment is not just from outside the EU. I mean, Britain was the top destination for inward investment from the rest of the EU as well. And that's very important because inward investment does tend to drive productivity. You know, productivity in foreign-owned companies tends to be higher than in domestically-owned ones. So it's very important for the UK economy. And if you see where it's coming from, I say you know, the UK has attracted inward investment from all parts of the world. But importantly, the single market was a big driver of that. Not the only driver, but a big driver of that. So that is essential in a you know in a post-Brexit future. Can you do it by cutting corporation tax to even lower levels? You know, could the UK go below Ireland's 12.5% corporation tax rate and be you know a kind of almost a super tax haven for businesses that want to invest? I think it's possible, but unlikely. You know, I think if you know the idea of a 10% corporation tax rate was quite, you know, it had, lots of people suggested that immediately after Brexit, but you know that doesn't fit in with the kind of body language of the new government, which is that you know all the rewards should not go to big business. You know, we need to think about a more inclusive economy, and it's quite hard to combine that with aggressive cuts in corporation tax. So I think that's probably gone as far as it can go. So to the extent that the corporate tax regime is attractive anyway, that will continue, but I don't think it's going to get more attractive. As I mentioned earlier, you know, UK labour market legislation, product market legislation, is very much at the you know the easier side of the OECD spectrum. You know, it ranges from here, New Zealand, right up to Belgium. Belgium most regulated, New Zealand least regulated, and the UK, you know, pretty low on that estimate. So, you know, I don't think, you know, again, that future of, you know, we're going to look after people, particularly people in insecure jobs, is going to be satisfied by, you know, making a flexible labour market and relatively low-regulated labour market even less regulated. So I don't think that is going to happen. It's vital to have, you know, good trading arrangements, and in particular, good trading arrangements for services in which we have comparative advantage, financial, professional business services. We need to have good trading arrangements. And I think that is the biggest challenge of all. I think it's a huge challenge to negotiate a successful exit from the EU, but an even bigger challenge at the moment. I mean, if you think of the glory days of trade liberalisation, they were in the 50s, 60s, 70s, to a certain extent the 80s, but, you know, since then, you know, multilateral trade negotiations have been pretty much becalmed. It's unlikely, it seems to me, that TTIP will go ahead, and there's a lot of opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership as well. It's popular among politicians in a way it wasn't, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, to be openly protectionist. And to try and negotiate, you know, new, aggressive, all-inclusive, all-singing, all-dancing trade deals in those circumstances are very difficult. So although the language is about, you know, we're going to be the champions of free trade, I think it's quite difficult to envisage that, at the moment anyway. I mean, you know, this is not going to happen for a couple of years at least, but this does not look like the climate in which it's going to be very easy to do that. So, you know, and this is perhaps a classic economists' answer that, on the one hand and on the other hand, you know, there are circumstances in which it is possible to achieve a better Brexit than might otherwise be the case, you know, to make the best of, a not very good hand. You know, the people who are having to deal with this within government, people having to respond to it elsewhere, didn't expect this and in general didn't want it. And disentangling us from our relationships with the EU is going to be quite difficult, and also framing new relationship. But there are better ways of doing it. You know, there are good ways of doing it, and there are bad ways of doing it. The bad way of doing it is to go for something that's almost a sort of short, sharp shock for the economy of immediate Brexit, and then things would. I think that short, sharp shock would turn into a very long and enduring shock. So it's got to be done intelligently. I hope that intelligence and good sense prevails. It could go either way. Either we could have a moderately good Brexit, or it could go very wrong indeed. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that, David. I'm tempted to say that it didn't really cheer us up as much as we'd hoped. But I wonder, just to start off, if I could ask a question from the chair. A number of us have had contact with Whitehall since Brexit. You will have far more contact than us with people involved in governments at different levels. And we know the Prime Minister has helpfully said that Brexit means Brexit. Call me an academic if you wish, but we seem to need a little bit more definition as to what Brexit might mean. And I wonder, in terms of your contacts with governments, whether you think government in the last 3 months is much further advanced in understanding what it wants from the European Union. In other words, on a scale of 1 to 10, after 3 months, how better do you think government is at knowing what it wants from Brexit?
Okay. I would say 2.5 on that one. And I think the, I mean, the, one of the problems is, of course, that there are different factions within government. And also, during the talk, there isn't an enormous amount of expertise to draw on. So I'm sure that, academics who specialise in this area, including at this institution, will be much in demand over the next few months. And when Theresa May had a Brexit away day at Chequers, and to try and at least start on the process of thinking about what kind of Brexit we want, what kind of Brexit she means by Brexit, and was very was very critical of the work that was brought along by the different departments. This hadn't really moved on from the campaign. The detail was not there, even the broad outlines of what kind of Brexit we want. So this is very preliminary. And if the government has to at least have a plan and a framework within the next 4 or 5 months, there is an enormous amount of work to do there, because I think it is still, incredibly in its infancy. And I mean, one of the things that that I think was astonishing about the referendum was that if you think about, we take many decisions in this country, and the decision on Brexit was arguably one of the biggest we will ever take, and the amount of preparation that was done. I mean, if you think about, the amount of thought, expert guidance, expert witnesses, you know, lots of work by consultants and all those things that have gone into the, so far, the non-decision about having a third runway at Heathrow, compared with, you know, a brief and, you know, and very unsatisfactory campaign. There should have been a white paper, there should have been, you know, and all these things should have been thought about. The only discussion of alternatives was really done in the, you know, the Treasury exercises, which were intended to show, and, you know, and did show in economic terms, how all those alternatives would be pretty bad. So, but there was no attempt to sort of model how we would get to those alternatives. So it's so, you know, they are starting from scratch.
Thank you. Well, let's now open it up to the audience. If I could invite you to, first of all, say who you are and then ask a question. Perhaps there are some of you who are ready to give us the benefits of your thoughts and a speech, etc. Could I simply ask you on this occasion to focus simply on a question rather than a long series of comments? There are colleagues in the red T-shirts with microphones. Could we take, first of all, I think there's the gentleman here. Would you say who you are and then the question, please? And we'll take a group of questions.
I'm Zaki. I'm an AT student from Arc Academy studying economics. I just wanted to know, what are the TPP and the TTIP?
Okay. Thank you. And we'll then go upstairs. There's a gentleman towards the front.
Michael Climes. I'm a journalist at Professional Pensions, a weekly trade publication. Could you tell us what Mr. Hammond is likely to do in the autumn statement? Because we don't seem to know a lot about him. What will he do or might not do? And in your answer, could you please, if you could, touch a bit on how that might affect UK pensions policy? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And could we take the, I'm sorry, the lady over here. Three rows in.
Hi, I'm Alice. I'm a philosophy graduate. So political wisdom in the UK has usually indicated that members of the public will vote in line with their economic self-interest. In the Brexit vote, communities that benefited most from the EU investment and grants voted most heavily to leave. Does this vote actually represent the triumph of ideas over raw self-interest and signal the beginning of a new period of principled political debate?
Well, thank you. Let's take those questions in turn. Then, first of all, perhaps you could say something about, very, very briefly, the implications of TTIP and the Pacific equivalent.
Yeah. I mean, I would encourage you to just use Google on that. But, you know, the... essentially, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is a broadly based trade and investment deal, as it suggests, which is quite controversial between the EU and the United States. Many European politicians say it's already dead in the water, and Donald Trump is very critical of its Pacific equivalent, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But there is plenty of material I would direct you towards on the internet on that. In terms of the new chancellor and the autumn statement, I mean, I think he will be more of a fiscal conservative than people have assumed. So I don't think this is the end of austerity. I think there's quite a lot of that will continue. There will be some infrastructure announcements. I think where it may be relevant to where you are coming from. I think one of the ambitions since 2010 has been to get institutional investors more involved in infrastructure, and some of them are post-Brexit are you know, are much more positive about that, you know, because I think they sense there is a greater need there. So that will be part of it. Some of it will be greater government spending, and that will be part of it. In terms of pensions themselves, it's quite difficult to say. I mean, you will remember that. In what turned out to be George Osborne's last budget, he wanted to substantially reform pension tax relief. And, it seems rather comical now, but it was decided that that was not the time to do it because it might, persuade people to vote for Leave. So go for something safer. And the two safe options, forced academisation of all schools and cuts in disability benefit, were even more controversial, and both of them, barely survived budget week. So, I don't think there is going to be a big, bold pension reform. I would be surprised by that. I think they will decide their other fish to fry. I mean, the question about politics and self-interest and so on. I mean, the interesting thing to me, if you looked at the referendum, was that. There was an issue there for, particularly for business. I mean, there was an issue there for government and trust in government and the ability of the Leave side to look like they were the voice of the people, even, when they were funded by some, pretty wealthy millionaires and run by people who've benefited from, the European Parliament and being members of the European Parliament for a number of years. So, but the idea that you could do that was one of the more successful things. I mean, one of the it was an appalling campaign, but it was also a clever one. One of the reasons why the Leave campaign bus was red was to appeal to Labour voters, to make it look as though, the Labour position was a Leave position. And given Jeremy Corbyn's attitude, it might well have been, So, you raise a very interesting point. I mean, were people, was it, and you looked at, Sunderland obviously was the first place to declare. You looked at Sunderland, you looked at Flintshire, Swindon, all of those places, Sunderland, Nissan, Flintshire, Airbus, Swindon have got Honda and BMW there. All of those places, local employers, multinational employers, had said, our best interests, your best interests, are served by staying in the EU. And in each of those places, you had 70% plus Leave votes. So, there was something about, even where it was locally important, it didn't work, so that's a loss of trust in business. Whether people were, whether it's a triumph of ideas or just, sheer cussedness, I don't know. But in many respects, that didn't, places like, Wales with a very low immigrant population, you would not, and beneficiaries of, EU projects, EU funding over many years, voting to leave. So maybe it was principled, or maybe it was just that, that the Leave campaign scare stories were better than the Remain campaigns. I don't know how principled it all was, but it was certainly a vote against, at least some economic self-interest, I think.
Okay, good. Let's take a few more votes. Mamma mia. A few more questions. Could we take the gentleman towards the front here, please? Could you wait for the microphone?
Hi, I'm John. I'm a retired Scottish nurse. We've been on a world tour of all of the other countries that have an opinion or that we want to compare ourselves with, but you've not mentioned even the fact that two-thirds of the Scots and a substantial number of the Northern Irish didn't want Brexit and that it could have major implications for the State of the Union.
Yep. Thank you. And let's come downstairs. The gentleman over here, please.
I'm Zach. I do conflict studies here. You talked a lot about what the UK should do and what the UK should want from a deal, but if a relatively stable British economy helps to legitimize Eurosceptic parties in other countries, What incentive does the EU have to give England anything it should want?
Okay, good. Thank you. And can we take the gentleman at the back?
Hi, my name's OP and I work in the financial services sector. You mentioned that generally since the Brexit result, that the political tide across Europe has generally swayed towards the mainstream. Do you think that will still be the case in 12 months' time if we see a Trump win in the US and the European elections in France and Germany favouring more right-wing groups?
Okay, good. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mention the Scottish Northern Irish vote. I mean, there is no doubt that that many people in Scotland felt very badly let down. I mean, interestingly enough, one of the reasons if you'd had the same vote, the same percentage votes, and the kind of turnout that you had in the Scottish referendum, then there would have, the gap would have, at the very least, been much narrower between Remain and Leave. I mean, people in Scotland, voters in Scotland, were, it was interesting that they voted, still convincingly in favour of Remain, because in some ways, the message was slightly mixed, because if you said, if the rest of the UK votes to leave, we vote to stay, then we want another referendum. And if you're a nationalist, then you might even have voted tactically for leave because not wanting to make it, or maybe not, the mechanism for that was not voting, which is why turnout wasn't as high as it could have been. I mean, the politics of Scottish independence are as they were. There is obviously a substantial minority in favour of independence. I don't think it's, looking at the polls we've had, and of course polls you have to take with a pinch of salt, we don't seem to have seen an enormous swing towards support for independence since the European referendum. And of course the economic numbers at the moment are heavily against it. I mean, an independent Scotland at the moment would have comfortably the largest budget deficit in Europe, and roughly 2.5 times the UK budget deficit. And part of that is oil, part of that is for structural reasons. So I think it was difficult in 2014 to make the economic case for independence. I think it would be even more difficult now. But you raise a very important point. Does the rest of Europe want to make it as difficult for the UK as possible, so as not to encourage the others? I think there is definitely that mood around, but I think there will also be a mood eventually of mutual self-interest. I think the pressure from business in the rest of Europe will not be to put up enormous tariff walls and so on between the UK and Europe. And so I think I would hope that common sense will prevail. But at the moment, the hardball will go on for some time. I think they want to, make sure that Britain feels quite chastened. They will have the other 27 will have their private meetings. We won't get invited. We've already given up on the presidency that we're going to have, and so on. So I think we'll the UK will be made to feel as though it's done something quite stupid by the rest of them. But then I think once they get down to negotiating, I hope that common sense does prevail. And even I think if I think people in the rest of Europe might look across at the UK and just look at the complexity of it all and the difficulty of negotiating new trade arrangements and think that they are better off where they are. And on the coming European elections, I think it's going to be very interesting. I mean, it's very hard to imagine Europe without Angela Merkel, and that has to be a possibility. We'll get, a new French president, and the direction and drive of Europe could change quite a lot. And there is a huge debate, obviously, between whether the Brexit vote means, if you take the Juncker view, means that we need more Europe, we need closer integration, or that it means that we have to take note of what the people actually think, which is that Europe is too distant, too elitist, and all those things. And that is the battle that will you know, and the outcome of those elections is very important in that, as will be, of course, the US election, and as you say.
Good, thank you. Let's take another round of questions then. Sorry, there's a gentleman here with his hand up. Yeah, please.
Hi, I'm Sam, and I also work in financial services. I just want to ask a question about experts. Prior to the vote, almost every expert in the land urged people to vote for Remain, but the electorate didn't listen to them. What can experts do to regain a stronger hold on public opinion?
Very good. Can we take the lady here, please?
Hi, my name is Segalina. I just finished my master's in European politics here at LSE. And my question is about passporting. Is it likely that British banks will lose their passporting rights? And if yes, what would be the impact on the City of London and on the financial services? Thank you.
Good, thanks. And can we take the gentleman in the middle, please?
I'm Matt. I'm an A-level economics student. You talked about the City of London. They have one of the highest votes to remain in the EU. Given that we're going to be losing access to the free market and the existing financial deals we had with the EU, what's the best outcome the city can expect from Brexit talks?
Good, thanks.
Okay. Thank you. On experts, I mean, I think there was, you know, that was very much the, we talked about this earlier, but I mean, that was very much the sense of it. And of course, Michael Gove said that people have had enough of experts during the campaign. I don't know whether, you know, voters were necessarily rejecting experts in the sense that I think many of them had, you know, decided, you know, on the basis of gut instinct that they were going to vote the way they did and probably didn't know an enormous... And they weren't following the day-to-day debate about whether 350 million was a made-up figure and it wouldn't go to the NHS and, you know, whether Turkey was about to join and so on. I think you know, we shouldn't underestimate the intelligence of voters, but we shouldn't overestimate it either. You know, and I think people, as I say, there were a string of reasons, you know, why people voted in the way they did on both sides. And while in the kind of, you know, the Westminster and the media village, all, you know, this was an outright rejection of experts, I think most people would just not have known. I mean, if for example, you take, you know, say somebody whose main source of news is listening to the radio, you know, BBC radio, watching the 10 o'clock news or the 6 o'clock news, they would have had the impression that, you know, there were one set of experts, expert economists, who said leaving would be really bad news and we'd be between 4 and 9% smaller as an economy by 2030. And then they would have immediately heard from another expert saying it's nonsense, we're going to be better off if we leave. And they would have had no way of knowing that, you know, on one side was 95% of the of professional economists. On the other side were 5%. They would have just heard the two views. And how are they to judge which one is, you know, which one is in the ascendancy? And so I think it was more the way that balance was presented by the national broadcasters, which meant it was very difficult for people to get to true expertise, I think, you know, because it was always, and I remember Paul Johnson of the IFS saying this, that, you know, that they... they did a report saying that, you know, the public finance, and, you know, the leave argument was that the public finances would be better off once we stopped contributing to the EU budget. And they did a report pointing out that the slower growth in the economy and other pressures would mean that public borrowing would be higher, you know, and it would be considerably higher as a result of Brexit. And the way that that was reported on the BBC quite early on in the day was that, you know, Leave campaigners have rejected a report from the IFS. It wasn't, you know, the IFS has done this report saying the public finance will be worse off. It was almost turned on its head straight away, and, you know, in the interests or the supposed interests of balance. So I don't know whether people really got to the experts sufficiently to be able to reject them, or they might have got a misleading impression. On two questions on, you know, city and the future. I think, you know, there is a debate about how... I think passporting will be difficult to retain. But there is a debate about how important it is. You may have seen that, you know, Moody's, the ratings agency, came out with a report yesterday saying it was perhaps less important than people thought, that they, you know, in many cases it's replicated or there are ways around it. And, you know, the city is quite ingenious at getting around these things. So I don't think it's a guarantee that things will be worse. But, you know, there are plenty of, you know, there are, if one thinks of the City of London, there are plenty of things that it does which the rest of the EU doesn't think it should be doing. You know, lots of euro-denominated transactions and so on, which it retained despite not being a member of the euro. And I think the rest of Europe will see this as an opportunity to get that stuff back to where they think it should belong, either, you know, in Frankfurt or Paris and places like that. So I think those are bigger dangers than maybe the formal business of passporting. And I've no doubt that, you know, there will be some transfer of jobs and activities from the city to the rest of the EU. The question is how big a factor that is, and of course, you know, the city has to compete not just in the EU but globally. And I think that will be an issue. I don't think it will necessarily be the location of choice for every international bank or financial services company.
Good, thanks. Let me remind you that we will have the lecture this Friday, giving a wider European view about the implications of Brexit for the future of the European Union, with the President of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, here in this theatre at 1:30. Can I also mention that upcoming events will be on the LSE events page, and more particularly, the LSE has a blog on Brexit, with many different contributions, with different points of view about the implications of Brexit. LSE Brexit is the blog. But before that, can you please join me in thanking our speaker this evening, David Smith.